I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we have journalist and author of the book, We Live for the We, The Political Power of Black Motherhood, Dani McLean. Today we talk with Dani about her amazing book, Social Justice in Raising Children, Reproductive Rights, The Maternal Mortality Crisis, and a whole lot more. Then we move from Dani's writing to her reading and discuss the book she loves, the authors she admires, and the things she would assign if she were a school teacher. You can connect with Dani and The Stacks in the show notes, and you can find details to everything we discussed on today's episode right there as well. Make sure you link up with The Stacks on social media to never miss out on announcements, events, giveaways, and more. If you love The Stacks and want to support the work we're doing on the show, join The Stacks Pack over on Patreon. That's a place where you can contribute to the work we're doing and get perks for yourself, like inside access to the show, including our virtual book club. To join The Stacks Pack, go to patreon.com/thestacks. I also want to give a shout out to Holly Noble, one of our newest members of The Stacks Pack. Thank you so much, Holly. Remember, if you're looking for a book recommendation from The Stacks, email us at askingthestacks@gmail.com. We'll give you a personalized on-air suggestion based on your reading tastes. Just send us your name, what you're looking for in a book, and be sure to include a few books you've liked and maybe some that just weren't for you, and we'll come up with the perfect book. Email us at askingthestacks@gmail.com. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and please, 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 please leave us a rating and a review. All right, let's dive into our conversation with author and journalist Dani McLean. All right, y'all, we're here today with author and journalist Dani McLean. Dani's book is called We Live for the We, The Political Power of Black Motherhood. Dani is also a contributing writer with The Nation and a fellow with Tite Media Center. Her work focuses on race, reproductive health, and activism. Dani, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very excited you're here. Before we dive into your work, do you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Let's see. I've been covering reproductive health and organizing and activism for the past, I'd say, 7 years. I got a fellowship through the Nation Institute, which is now Tite Media Center, about 7 years ago. And that has allowed me to carve out this beat. Initially the fellowship was for reproductive rights coverage, but as I started digging in and kind of looking at how other people covered reproductive rights, I realized that what really called to me was the reproductive justice framework, which I was introduced to by mostly Black organizers and activists, certainly people of color who were, teaching me about the reproductive justice framework is the right to have a child, the right to not have a child, and the right to parent the children that we have in safe and healthy communities. So that really opened up a lot for me in terms of thinking about how I could tell stories and the kind of reporting that I wanted to do. So I've been, you know, covering that beat for the past 7 years. Prior to that, I was a newspaper reporter. I also worked for social justice organizations, civil rights organizations, Color of Change, and Drug Policy Alliance. So I have about 20 years of kind of being back and forth between reporting and working as a strategist or as a comms person for different nonprofit organizations. So that's like my professional life. And then, you know, as we'll discuss, I'm mother to my daughter, Isabel, who will be 3 next month. And we live in Cincinnati, which is my hometown, and my mom, we were very close with my mom and with her other grandmother. And yeah, we just have a really sweet life. And right now we're here in LA on vacation, which is also lovely. So it's
great. And it's a win for me because I get to sit down with you.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's one of the joys of living in LA is that people always come through.
Right.
But I have been to Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah.
I've been to Cincinnati once. I actually kind of really liked it. Surprisingly, thought it was like a cute place.
Yeah. I think there's more to do there than people expect.
We were there. One of my dad's best friends was the manager of the Reds. So we were there for baseball games. So we obviously had like that built in, but it was great. Had a great time. So your book is about, we kind of touched on this before just now, but I was saying to you that I kind of wasn't expecting to like really connect with your book because I'm not a mother and I don't think of myself in that way. But one of the things that's really special about your book is that it kind of reframes the idea of what it means to be a mother or mothering. And you kind of make a distinction between motherhood and mothering and the act of mothering versus like the title mother.
Yeah.
Will you talk a little bit about that and why it's important?
Yeah. So this is something that I've learned from other Black scholars and writers. I think most specifically, there's a book called Revolutionary Mothering. That's an anthology that was edited by China Martins, Alexis Pauline Gums, and Maya Williams. And it came out, I want to say like 3 years ago, maybe. And it's just this beautiful collection of essays and poetry and various reflections from people who are engaged in mothering in any number of ways. And the introduction really lays out, maybe it's not the introduction, but I know, you know, the kind of some point in the book early on that frames what they're doing. Lays out this idea that, you know, motherhood is kind of this state of being, and we assume that we know who a mother is and what a mother looks like. Whereas if we think of mothering as caregiving and the kind of act of mothering, it really can be undertaken by anyone, you know, across gender, across, you know, biological ties, whether or not biological and blood ties are in place. And so it really, I think, opens up our discussion when we talk about the act of mothering as opposed to these fixed ideas of who a mother is and like motherhood as a state of being. So, but then, you know, this is also something that I learned a lot from reading Patricia Hill Collins, who's a sociologist, and really just, you know, her writing has been critical in the scholarship of Black motherhood, where she wrote a lot about other mothering, community mothering, again, really broadening these ideas of what it means to mother. You know, we're not just talking about these kind of nuclear family units. We're talking about what it means to feel responsible maybe for your own child, but then certainly that child's peers, because you realize that what's good for your kid is going to be good for the kids, you know, in the neighborhood, the peers. And so, you know, she also talked a lot about mothering as a kind of foundational step toward community organizing and activism, because once you're advocating on behalf of your family and your children, you begin to see what are the needs in this community. And so it's kind of like you know, she talked about ways in which it's been a stepping stone toward deeper community engagement. And so I was really informed by people like, you know, the co-editors of that anthology, Patricia Hill Collins, Audre Lorde, these people, mostly Black people who have been writing about mothering in these ways that really blow up our kind of antiquated notions of what it means to be a mother.
Right. It almost feels like mothering as community organizing in a sense, that it's like a much bigger job than just having a child, right? Like that it is so much more involved and it requires, and you go through in your book, you have different sections. So there's birth, there's home, there's play, there's power, there's spirit. Like there's all these different sections and each one touches on kind of a different aspect of mothering, but you look at them all together. And I guess what I'm saying is that I never had really thought about all these different roles that a mother figure has and how important these different spheres of life are and how intersectional they are, right? Mm-hmm. Like you talk about play and you talk about school, and those two chapters are very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are.
Like that those two things, like the ability for a young child, Black child, to be able to play freely and safely and to have the ability to make mistakes or throw a rock at another child and not be suspended exactly. for it. And these types of, you know, so all that I found really interesting. But one of the topics that I think is probably the most like hot button right now mm-hmm. would be maternal mm-hmm. mortality
yeah.
in, you know, especially for, or definitely for Black women. And I'm sure the story that most people are familiar with was Serena Williams mm-hmm. and her blood clots and how, yes. you know, all this stuff. And you talk about your own birth story mm-hmm. in the book, and I think Tressie McMillan Cottom talks yes. about it in her book, Thick, also.
I read the essay, the part that was excerpted in Time.
Okay, yeah. And she talks about a very similar story. She was going into labor and, like, nobody believed her.
Right.
But I guess my question for you is, what are the ways that you feel like Black women can advocate for themselves in those spaces, in the doctor's office, with their nurse, with their, you know, you talk a lot about midwives and doulas in the book also. Mm-hmm. So kind of just like, what are the places where you feel like we can make progress as Black women?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I think the book is really a mix of reporting and memoir, mm-hmm. you know, kind of reflections on like just my experiences as a new mom or as a pregnant person. And so for the maternal, the first chapter of the book, as you mentioned, is called Birth, and it really is grounded in my experience with pregnancy and birth, but also this larger question of what's going on with the Black maternal health crisis, because that's really what it is. When we mm-hmm. talk about the maternal health crisis in the United States, we're talking about Black people bearing the brunt of this, the crisis. And so when I was in my, I think I was in my third trimester, it was the summer before she was born. She was born in late August. I started reporting this story on Black maternal health. And I knew the statistics. I knew that Black women were 3 to 4 times more likely than white women to die from pregnancy-related complications. I knew the problem. I had read a lot about the problem, but I felt like there wasn't a lot of reporting on or rigorous discussion around potential solutions. And so I started calling my contacts in reproductive justice organizing. I remember I called Monica Simpson at Sister Song. I called Jana Zinzi, who's a communications person who does a lot of work. She used to do a lot of work with the reproductive justice movement. But I called National Advocates for Pregnant Women. I started reaching out to people who I had interviewed for other stories, but I figured they have to know about,
right.
you know, there's a whole world of birth justice that my reporting hadn't even touched on. So I started reaching out to them, and really, that's when and then I also dug into the medical journals and started reading the research and talking to, medical professionals, researchers, and that kind of thing. And what I learned was that, implicit bias or racism, white supremacy is really a big part of the problem
right.
here, is that, Black people aren't being listened to when they start experiencing symptoms. So you pointed it out with Serena Williams, you know, I have a history of blood clots and she's not being listened to. And so I started learning about the ways in which, Black people were, you know, we know when we don't feel well,
right?
But when we have a nurse or an OB or someone assisting us in our pregnancy and birth who won't listen to us, that's very dangerous. I also started reading about really just the physiological impacts of stress, right?
Mm.
What the ways in which white supremacy tears down our bodies. Mm. And so this is like structural racism. What does it mean when you can't get that loan to get your house in the neighborhood where you want, or your child is like, you know, 3 and getting kicked out of preschool, or
right.
like these things where it's like, you actually have to deal with what that feels like, right, and how you live a life in which you're constantly bombarded with these challenges that you shouldn't have to deal with. And then also just microaggressions and the daily slights, you know, somebody acting like they don't see you when you go into a store, or they see you, you know, and they're following you around. Just these daily ways that we, that we experience white supremacy. And so what I began to learn, and so what I got curious about is what happens what if we started birthing with people who we believed could see our humanity?
Right.
So what if we began to choose birth workers, whether it be an OB or a midwife or a doula, who we feel like is grounded in the value system that we're grounded in, and mm-hmm. who can, you know, really see us. So I think that that's one of, I think people have a number of ideas about what can help. But one of the things that I'm really interested in is this kind of movement among Black birth workers claiming the space and really training up. There's like all these training programs, you know, that are really focused on building the core of Black birth workers. And so I think that's one thing. I also think just knowing what our rights are within medical settings. You know, mm-hmm. I talk in the book about, I'm a journalist and I'm not particularly shy. I'm used to asking questions of experts, so-called experts. I'm used to like what it feels like when you're, you know, you know that this person has a lot more knowledge than you and power right. than you. That's my job, is to ask questions of the powerful. Right. And so I realized that that was one way in which I was privileged, because right. I didn't feel embarrassed making a total nuisance of myself. But I think that that's something that we all should feel empowered to do, is, you know, ask these questions. So I think that there are a number of things that we can do. I also think, you know, the story that came from that reporting, it was a cover story in The Nation that came out February of 2017, and that forms the kind of basis of the first chapter of the book. I think that we've seen this explosion in reporting on the Black maternal health crisis in the past 2 years.
Yeah.
Right? We saw that beautiful New York Times cover story by Linda Villarosa. We've seen the collaboration between NPR and ProPublica really drawing attention to the maternal health crisis and finally putting a fine point on the fact that this is about race,
right?
You know, this is not right. a maternal health crisis that everyone's experiencing, that Black people, Black families are really on the front lines of this battle.
Right. So you don't know this, but some of my listeners do. My husband's actually an OBGYN.
Wow.
And one of the things that he and I talk about a lot, and he's white, and one of the things we talk about a lot is, and his practice, there's 25 doctors and I want to say, or OBs, and I want to say about 8 or 10 of them are Black women,
oh, wow.
which was something that stuck out to me yeah. as soon as he got hired there. Cause I was like, this isn't normal, right? Like
yeah.
the people you work with, that's not who normal people see when they go, like that percentage just can't possibly be adequate. Like that can't be the medium or what medium across the country, because there's no way it's so many,
right.
you know, like, and so yeah. that's one of the things. When I think like, oh, when I have kids, like I'm so lucky that my husband works at a place with this percentage. And that's just the OBs. But I think 3 of the 4 midwives are Black
wow.
men. It's just like crazy. I mean, his hospital is in Baldwin Hills area. So that's a very Black population, yeah. but still. And I think like, that has been really helpful for him as well as a white man to be in a place where you see all these powerful Black women who are doing the work. And I don't have a study that says his hospital is doing any better than
yeah,
anyone
right,
else's,
right.
but just the comfort level of that, you know, and I feel like that's got to be pretty special for those patients, like that they walk in and they have that option.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had my daughter in Dayton, which is like okay. 45 minutes north of Cincinnati, but I had lived in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Where I'm from.
Okay.
I'm from Oakland.
Yeah.
I heard a lot in your book.
Right, right,
like,
right. Yeah. I lived in Oakland for, you know, 6 or 7 years. I lived in New York City for a long time. I've lived in these different, I worked at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So I lived in Milwaukee. I interned at the Miami Herald. So I lived in Miami very briefly, but I've lived a lot of different places around the country. And I know you're exactly right. It depends on where you are,
right.
you know, where you are in the country or even within a city that's right. going to dictate what kind of care you have right. access to.
And my husband and I were just talking about this last night, this was totally unrelated, but he was telling me about a patient who wanted to have a hysterectomy and was very young. And he had to pass it on to his boss. And I was like, oh, do you think your boss will approve it? And he was like, yeah, I think so. She usually does whatever the patients want. But I was like, that's so crazy that if this woman had gone to a doctor at, you know, in Nevada or in Fresno or mm-hmm. another, mm-hmm. he mentioned another hospital here in LA, mm-hmm. they probably would have gotten told no.
Yeah.
And like that to me is one of the biggest travesties of the healthcare system is that people aren't able to get the same healthcare and it's so dependent on your zip code or your doctor's zip code or, you know, I think that's like really a big, big problem.
Yeah.
That like the rights of the patient are determined by the doctors and that's determined kind of like by where you are.
Yeah. And also who the patient is, right? Because some, you know, there's a lot of conversation around reproductive coercion and who actually gets pressured to get a hysterectomy or an IUD or some other kind of long-acting reversible contraception.
Yeah, there's just so much there. I do kind of want to move off this a little bit to education. Sure. And it's kind of connected, actually. You talk about in the book about education and about diversity in schools and this idea of like children of color versus black and brown children and how, you know, I believe it's a friend of yours. Her child's in a school with like lots of children of color, but it's mostly like Asian Americans, children and white children. And that her child or children were the only black or brown children in the classroom. And then that kind of brought to this conversation about teachers. Mm-hmm. And just because a teacher is black or brown doesn't necessarily mean that a teacher is an advocate for black and brown children. And I think that kind of ties into the doctor conversation because just because doctor is black and brown doesn't mean that they're not also influenced by white supremacy or the feeling that they need to follow the standards of white supremacy. And I wonder like what you think, like, I wonder how teachers can do better by students and how schools can do better by black and brown students specifically, as opposed to this idea of color, which generally tends to wash out black and brown.
Yeah.
It's a lot. That's a big question.
No. I'm with you. I mean, so you're referring to Aya de Leon, who's a writer and academic who lives in Berkeley, and she was talking, and I'm glad you brought this up because I feel like this is a very California conversation.
Yeah, I think
because what she was talking about actually is that she had her daughter at different points in schools where a lot of people identified as being of color, but they might be like, maybe they have a black grandparent.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, so they're like, they might identify as being even black or just like of color or multiracial, but they're very light skinned and possibly even white passing or the, you know, Latinx or Asian or, but just like that people are multiracial, but how does that read differently when there's essentially very, very light skinned and white passing and like having access to white privilege? And that she felt very clear as someone who has like explicit, you know, a phenotypically black child, like a brown skinned child, that even though her daughter might be in class with other of color kids, that being black is a very specific thing. And so she'd experience the classroom in a particular way, which I'm glad you brought that up because I felt like that's a really important point that she made.
Yeah.
Because we talk about diversity in such basic ways that don't really get at the complexities of like, well, skin color, like let's also talk about skin color, not just like culture or heritage.
Right. And also proximity to whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
I think that comes up a lot too, like with like the model immigrant idea, right? Like I think that those are all tied together, that the darkness of a child is not, it's not simply just about being diverse or of color, but that it is a spectrum, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to your point about teachers, like what can teachers do? I think that there's, you know, the other person in the book who speaks a lot to this is a woman named Jessica Black, who also lives in the Bay Area. She's in Pittsburgh, California, so East Bay. And she talked to me a lot about the struggles that her black children have had in school. And so that she really opened up an interesting conversation around discipline. Because in addition to being a mom, she works for the Black Organizing Project on like the school to prison pipeline. So she's coaching parents who are dealing, you know, who are supporting their children through disciplinary proceedings. And she herself as a parent has been through disciplinary proceedings with her as her children are being, you know, suspended or experiencing some other kind of discipline. And so, you know, one of the things that I learned from her and from the research that I've done, I used to be a schools reporter when I was at the Journal Sentinel. So this is something I've been thinking about for a long time. You know, I think that they're one of the things that teachers can do, educators can do, because it also is something that falls on the shoulders of administrators, is just to think seriously about these areas of discipline that are highly subjective, right? So this whole category what's it called? It's basically willful defiance, right?
Yeah.
Willful defiance, which is like, okay, what exactly is the child's behavior actually like a threat, you know, or are you because of who you are culturally and your mm-hmm. kind of read, are you experiencing it as something that really is just a challenge to your authority that you want to squash as quickly as possible?
Right.
So I think one of the things that educators can do is look at these broad, and this is happening, right? You have some districts that are doing away with willful defiance as a disciplinary category, like for certain, you know, grades, or district wide. But looking at these highly subjective discipline categories, and realizing that these are areas where racism and white supremacy can creep in and dictate who is actually being pushed out of classrooms.
Right.
And then understanding how high the stakes are, you know, when in the school to prison pipeline, I mean, what is meant by that is you cut down on the classroom time that a student has, and you all of a sudden the chances that they're going to have contact with law enforcement, you know, increase. Their lifetime earnings, you know, you're talking about cutting into not only their ability to like pass or graduate, but how much money are they going to be able to make? How employable are they going to be over the course of their lives?
I never thought of it that taken it quite that far, I guess, in my mind.
Yeah. And I think that that's one of the useful about that whole frame of the school to prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. It talks about, you have to think about this student's life, you know, possibilities and expectations over the course of their life. Just because you got fed up because they slammed a book on the table or raised their voice, what are you doing that could possibly, you know, really affect how their lives unfold?
Right. Before we move off your book, which we're not really going to move off because I have a lot of questions that I'll circle back to it later, but what is the best advice that you received? Because a lot of your book is also kind of you searching for answers for yourself and your family.
Right.
So what's the best advice you received, or something that maybe you would pass on to someone else? How to raise children who are active and engaged. There's a whole section on that, which I found really amazing. But I guess for Black children, but also for a lot of people who I feel like it's very, you know, in right now, which in a good way, and not to be divisive or anything, but it's very in to want to make sure that you're parenting your children to be aware of, you know, privilege and bias and racism and all that stuff. So what kind of advice can you give for parents to like raise better white boys or raise better Black women or raise better, you know, Honduran gender non-binary, you know, like how can we be doing better by our children as parents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the best advice that I got, and it came up again and again, was just the importance of community.
Mm.
You know, I moved home to Cincinnati from the Bay Area where I lived, as I mentioned, and I've lived in these places where there is the like amazing childcare co-op or preschool co-op. It's all these politicized parents of color who are thinking really critically about the curriculum that they're going to put together so that their kids are playing together and learning together. I've lived in these cities where, you know, you have Dance Africa and just these incredible cultural offerings that are just part of living in New York City, for example.
Right.
And so living back in the Midwest, I have had a lot of questions. I've had to do a lot of soul searching around, like maybe I should just move back to one of my favorite cities on the coast because I can see more easily how I can expose my daughter to the things that I want for her in her life. And when I would bring that up with people, there's a great exchange in the book that I have with, this woman named Kim Yamoyo, who's retired educator. She worked in Cincinnati Public Schools for many years, but she's just lived all over the world. She's incredible. And she says, you know, you can't make excuses for yourself. Like you can't say, if only we were in LA or whatever. You have to create that community for your child wherever you are. And it's possible. Don't think that it's not possible. And so in many ways, and then I also interview another elder, Rosalind Prudhomme, who was born and raised in Barbados. And she talks about the importance of that village, you know, like it beyond her nuclear family, that it was a village who took responsibility for children. And, having those conversations and others really made me check my snobbery, right? Cause really what I'm saying is like, oh, I'm here in my hometown and it's so backwards and this and that. But the reality is I grew up there.
Right. And you're fine.
And I'm
fine. You're more than fine. You're thriving.
Know? Yeah. And like I had people, and how did I grow up there? Because I had people who cared about me and mm-hmm. who loved me and who would say, oh, this art exhibit is in town. Let's go. Oh, have you read this book? I think you'd love it, you know,
right.
Or like, let's go on that trip to Chicago so we can see this museum. And so, so just back to this point of like, yes, exposure, right. But also that, responsibility of exposure shouldn't just fall on the parent's shoulders. Mm-hmm. It's important that you put together a team of people who love your child, who are also going to take responsibility for right. raising them up. Right. So right now I'm here because my two dear friends, Adrian Brown and Jody Tanita, are with my three-year-old, walking her on the beach, aww. Telling her stories. And they've been, even though we don't live in the same city, we live in three different cities. That's my, you know, those are my girls. That's my family.
Right.
And they've known my daughter since she was born. And so I think that the best advice I got was to put together that community, be around like-minded people who are going to, who share your values and are going to help you instill those values in your child.
Right. And I kind of feel like what I also hear you saying is to people who maybe aren't the parent,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
show up,
yep.
offer to take, you know, your friend's kid to the museum, to an exhibit that maybe the parent wouldn't be exposed to, you know, like
exactly.
it's not just responding and ask for people who are asking for help, but
right.
also being a proactive mother type figure or father type figure mm-hmm. or parent type figure and saying, oh, you know, like I have goddaughters and I like to, you know, my goddaughter got on honor roll. So we took her out to like a really nice dinner,
yeah.
which is just something that she wouldn't have done.
Right. Exactly.
Because I'm the nerdy aunt who's really cares about reading in school.
Exactly.
You know, so like that was something that I was like, I can take this on, and like figuring out the things that you can take on, even if you're not the parent, to help, you know, raise
that's
that
right.
child on your own.
That's right. Yeah. I think it's critical. I think, a lot of people get into these, you know, I've had a few conversations recently with women who are like in their late 40s or early 40s or coming up on mid 40s who feel really ambivalent about having kids, but mm-hmm. also feel like, what's wrong with me? You know, am I going to regret not
right.
doing this? And I understand that, and I'm not, but I also think there are so many ways that you can show up in a child's life
right.
and build those relationships that
right.
it's just worth considering. And then also the peers, like when, as you build those communities, you want adults in your child's life who are going to care for them, but also they need to kind of curating their peers, right?
Yeah.
So you can grow them up together and, you know, they have like these friendships that last over years, decades
right.
even. And you and the other child's caregivers, you share values. So
right.
you do, you know, okay, there's a march. Are we going to take our kids? Let's help them make signs
right.
so that they have some understanding of what we're out here marching about or talking about. So curating a peer group for them, I think, is another part of that community building.
That's so brilliant. I love that. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in store. And now save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, we're going to move towards other people's books now.
Okay.
So something that we do here is called Ask the Stacks, where listeners send in like a question. They're looking for a book recommendation.
Oh, okay.
And they email us at askingthestacks@gmail.com. And so today's one is like pretty open. So I didn't even prep you at all on this. So okay. We'll see how you do. Okay, this is from Tiffany K. Tiffany says, I'm a former avid reader, only now getting back to pleasure reading after finishing a doctoral program and a subsequent monograph project for Routledge and three kids deep. That's insignificant compared to the fact that I now finally have time for guiltless free reading. I tend to like books that feel real, if they're fiction, or have some historical or religious tie-in. I'm not personally religious, but I find it fascinating. I like biographies, though I haven't read a ton, and I don't particularly care for sci-fi or anything futuristic. I'd love to be exposed to authors of color, unique bits of history, or anything you might suggest. I don't have staying power, so it has to get me interested right away. And then she gave a few books that she liked. Okay. So she said The Joy Luck Club, Columbine, Prozac Nation, Virgin Suicides, and Stiff. It's like a lot of books. I obviously got this in advance, so I'll give a few of my answers while you think, okay? So my first one for you, Tiffany, is The Mothers by Britt Bennett.
I love that book.
It's a great book. It kind of is not really, it's a little bit about religion. It's just a really great story. Mm-hmm. It's really well written and the cover's gorgeous. And then for your religious love, I picked Under the Banner of Heaven by John Krakauer, which is about this like murder and the Mormon fundamentalist church, and it's crazy. And anything by John Krakauer, I highly recommend, but this one's great. And then the other one that's kind of a unique little bit of history is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's sciency. It's about this time in America. It's about this black woman. It's actually written by a white woman, so it's not an author of color, but it's a story about a black woman and her family and the medical industry. And it's pretty captivating from the start. So those would be my three. You don't have to do three. You can do one.
Yeah.
You can also have time to think. Don't worry.
So I'll second The Mothers. I think that is what that touches on. She said that she wants something that will grab her from the start. That's just a great, easy read. It will grab you. And it is about religion.
It is about religion.
In kind of a subtle way. Kind of, you know, it's about a preacher's kid.
Yeah. It has a religious tie-in.
Yeah. This, you know, I'll just mention this. There's a book called The Buddha by Karen Armstrong. Okay. It's a pretty easy to read telling of the Buddha's life. Mm. Like if you have any interest in Buddhism, it's a way to kind of get yourself situated in understanding like who was the Buddha, you know, what was this kind of transformation from, you know, a prince, 5th century BC into this, spiritual figure. Who is obviously revered today. And you know, I write in the book, actually, one of my chapters is about my spiritual practice and kind of what I think about a parent's role in giving their child a moral compass and a kind of spiritual grounding. And I write about you know, having grown up Christian and as an adult coming into Buddhism and meditation. And so that was one of the first books that I read that kind of got me situated. So yeah, I would recommend Karen Armstrong's The Buddha if you have any interest in
that. That's so good. Also in your book, you talk about doing like a week-long silent retreat, mm-hmm. which I thought sounded amazing and also like my personal nightmare because I cannot talk, which right. is why I created a podcast. People have to listen to me talk all the time when no one else is home.
Yeah.
Okay. So now it's time for your questions from the Stacks questionnaire. We always start here. Two books you love and one book you hate. And it can just be today. It doesn't have to be all time. It can just be, mm-hmm. you know, not too much pressure.
I love Paradise by Toni Morrison.
Mm.
I love this book called Women Who Run with the Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes. It's just this kind of like epic look at the myths, like mythology around femininity
mm-hmm.
and the psyche. I always come back to that book. A book that I hate. This is so random that this popped into my head. There's this book. So, okay, Across Five Aprils. It's like, I don't even know. So this has me thinking about how middle school literature, like the literature that, I don't know how old you are, but I feel like certainly when I was in like 6th through 8th grades, we read all these books where it was like, why is this the assignment? Why is this the curriculum right, for middle-aged right. readers? And this book, Across Five Aprils, is this telling of these families involved in the Civil War. It's really funny that that just popped into my head. But I think it's a larger commentary on like how I went through this whole period of life as a preteen where the books I was being introduced to through school were just not great.
Yeah, I think that was true for me also. I also wonder, like, because there's some books that you read in school that, like, everyone's like, yeah, we read that in school. Mm-hmm. Like, we read, what's the conch?
Lord of the Flies. A separate piece.
Yeah, so we read that, like, and I feel like everyone reads that. But then I also read Ender's Game in middle school.
Yeah, that's another common? I think that is common.
I don't even, like, I'm like, it was a video it's game random. Book. It's so random,
the books you get assigned as a junior high student.
And, like, Go Why? Ask Alice we read, which was, like, a little aggressive, I feel like, for sixth grade, but it was, like, part of sex ed.
Right,
and
right.
we read it out loud, and I'll never forget. Awkward. Yeah, our teacher read it out loud to us, and I'll never forget this kid in my class was, like, I guess there was a part where it says like anal sex or something. And someone was like, what's anal sex? And another kid in class goes, it's when you have sex in the butthole.
Well,
and I was like, I feel like this is getting out of control. Yeah. Like as a student, I was like, I feel like you guys have lost the room. Like, right. I don't know about this. This might have been a take home assignment.
Right. We didn't need to read this out loud.
I don't know about the out loud part, but anyways, what's the last like really great book you read?
Well, you know, I really liked An American Marriage.
Mm.
You know, I don't read a lot of fiction.
Yeah.
I very rarely read fiction, actually. But then every once in a while, it's usually my mom will turn me on to something she's reading in her book club. Right. And I, you know, books. So the time that I have to read, the time when I could read would be after I put my daughter to bed. Mm-hmm. So basically like, you know, from 9 to midnight I could read. Uh-huh. And what I'd much rather do after I clean my kitchen is sit and watch television. Mm. I'm going to be just honest. That's okay. Watch like, you know, these amazing series that are on TV right now. But I remember with An American Marriage, just I would put her to sleep and I couldn't wait to get back to what was happening because, you know, it was such a quick and easy read. So that's the last book I read that I got really excited
that
about.
That actually might be a really good recommendation for Tiffany.
Mm.
That's probably a good one. Mm-hmm. That's pretty compelling from the start. And it's an author of color.
That's
and
right.
It's a really good story.
Tyari Jones. And I also just love like now I love podcasts and sex. Oh, what's the Anna Sales
sex,
podcast?
Sex, drugs, and money or something.
Yeah. Sex, death, and money.
Sex, death, and money.
Tyari Jones has been on there twice.
Oh, she has?
Yeah. And the interviews are so one time Anna Sales interviewing her. The other time she's interviewing, oh my gosh, I'm going to forget. But it's like this brilliant black artist. It's not Betty Saar. I'm blanking.
It's okay. I'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, please do. This just came out like 2 weeks ago.
Okay, perfect.
But anyway, so in addition to really loving the book, I love to listen to her just talk about her life and her
interests. She's really great. She's really brilliant. What are you reading right now?
Oh man, what am I reading right now? I'm reading, well, I just finished The Light of the World, which I'm excited for us to talk
about.
Yes,
we'll talk about that next week.
And, you know, I'm reading a ton of news, which is what I do.
That's allowed.
My job.
That's
yeah.
more than allowed. You don't have to read a book.
I know.
There's so much news right now.
I read a lot of news. And
what's your go-to publication?
I'm so boring. The New York Times. Okay. That's the first thing I read every day.
That's
yeah,
not boring.
The Times. I mean, not boring, but like, it's pretty expected. But yeah, I read the Times just to get a sense for what's happening in the world. And, I listen to the Daily. I really like the Daily podcast.
Though recently, I have to be honest, in the last few months, I've started being more selective when I listen. I used to listen to every episode.
Same.
And now I'm kind of like, do I care? Cause they did a few that was like, one was like Mitch McConnell and then one was like Lindsey Graham. And I was like, I don't know that I need to have these people humanized right now when they're doing like such shitty stuff in the world. Like, I don't know. I don't need like Michael Barbaro to be like, why do you think Mitch McConnell? Like,
right,
you know, so like I started getting a little bit more like, do I want to listen today?
Yeah. No, that I would say the same. And I also, one thing about just getting older, I'm like, I am very ignorant when it comes to international news. Mm-hmm. And I want to like at least kind of know the gist of what's happening, global trends.
Right.
But if he's going to do a deep dive on some issue that I just know that it's taking up space that I need to have focused on some domestic issue, I'm going to skip it.
I am the same. Like they did the whole like Brexit trilogy or quadrilogy or whatever. And I listened to the first two and then I was like, I can't do this.
Right. I will say before we move on, I just read the Elizabeth Warren profile in the New Yorker and I really enjoyed that. And
good.
Yeah, it's good. It gets into the details of like, well, how does she expect to pay for all this stuff?
Right.
And yeah, I really, I enjoyed that. So I will also say I'm a New Yorker reader. So usually the last thing I read was probably like Hilton Alls or, the TV critic, Emily Nussbaum.
Her book just came out.
Oh, I didn't know
that. It's right
that.
Behind you. It's called I Like to Watch, and it's about TV. You probably would like it.
Oh, yeah.
It's about, like, the new age of television.
Yeah.
She's real smart.
Yeah, she is really smart. I like her criticism a lot. So probably the last thing I read was, you know, if not something on the New York Times website, something by Hilton Alls or Vincent Cunningham or Emily Nussbaum in the New Yorker. And that Elizabeth Warren profile I thought was quite good.
Mm. Do you have any books that are coming out soon that are newly released that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, there's a book called Motherhood So White by Nefertiti Austin, I think. Her book is coming out later this year and I think is important. I haven't read it yet, but, you know, I think there are a lot of books right now that are challenging this kind of traditional understanding of motherhood as being the province of white writers and white women. And she's a black woman who's writing about her experience. I don't think Imani Perry's book is out yet. Is it A Letter to My Sons?
I don't know.
And I'm not even sure that that's the title, but it is. I'm so sorry.
No, I don't care. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Honestly, nobody remembers book titles and authors. Like, I myself, if I don't like write it down, I mess it up.
Yeah,
so don't worry.
No, and you even gave me a heads up, but
don't worry.
So Imani Perry's book is, touches on parenting. She's a black woman. I'm very excited to read that book. And then I just saw that, Edwidge Dandekot has a book coming out at the end of August that I'm excited.
I don't know who that is.
She's a Haitian American writer based in Miami.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Do you read multiple, like, can you hold multiple books in your mind at a time, or are you what I like to call a one book pony?
No, you should see my bedside table at home. It's just covered in books.
Isn't
it? And that's because I don't do a lot of reading just for pleasure. I read because I have a question, that I need the answer to. So, there's probably like a book on my bedside. There is in fact a book on my bedside about, like autoimmune disorder, because I have a lot of questions around, you know, autoimmune disorder right now that I'm trying to understand. I know for sure that Women Who Run With the Wolves is on my bedside table because I've been interested in, symbolism and like dreams, dream meaning, and, just thinking about womanhood. And so that's a book that I often turn to. So I am not a one book person. Mm-hmm. I typically have like half a dozen questions that I'm to sort through. And I have gone to the library and gotten at least half a dozen books that are going to help me figure out, learn more about whatever that question is.
And is that kind of how you work when you're researching for your own stuff? Like you kind of start with a question and pull a bunch of books?
For sure. So when I was working on We Live for the We, you know, I remember early on, there's a Sheree Marat. I actually went to a presentation, group that's based in Southern California, Chicana Motherwork. They just came out with an anthology called Chicana Motherwork. I went to a presentation and learned through that talk that Sheree Moraga had written a book about being pregnant and giving birth. And so I think that book is called Waiting in the Wings, but I'm not sure. And so I was like, okay, I want to read this. I reread, the Anne Lamott book about being pregnant. It's about the first year of her son's life. It's not Bird by Bird, which is another great Anne Lamott book. So I read that. I read Asha Bandele's Something Like Beautiful, which is about her experience as a single mother. I went back to my Audre Lorde. So yeah, I surrounded myself with books that I knew were going to help me at least know what the existing literature was, mm-hmm. and then figure out like, some of these people have questions that are similar to mine. How did they answer them for themselves? Right. So yeah, that was very much a part of my process in writing the book.
That's such an interesting, I never really thought about approaching your writing with like the questions, but I think that's really interesting. And I think that is something that makes your work very powerful because it feels like your reader is going along with you and kind of figuring it out too and getting to ask their own questions. Like feels like a safe space for questioning, I think, mm-hmm. which is really nice. Do you have a favorite bookstore specifically in Cincinnati?
Yeah, I do. So our major independent bookstore is called Joseph Beth Booksellers. Okay. And I love Joseph Beth. I did my launch event there when the book came out April 2nd. I was in conversation with my dear friend, local superstar writer, Kathy Y. Wilson, longtime columnist for Cincinnati City Beat. She and I were in conversation there at Joseph Beth, and the bookseller there, Michael Link, is fantastic and brings through incredible authors so that we in Cincinnati have, you know, access to these great writers. So I like Joseph Beth. I also, my friends own a record store called Shake It Records. That's just down the street from my house. And it is primarily a record store and they focus on vinyl, but they have a great books. It's mostly a used book selection, but they have new books as well. And so I go in there. It's just a favorite place to stop by and browse.
I love a used book.
I know.
I love a used book. It makes me so excited. I love like when there's like a note in it something, or like someone else's bookmark, or like a weird, like a phone number. Ugh, I'm so into it. It's like a mystery.
For your listeners, the look on her face is amazing right now.
I love a used book.
She talks about her love for used books.
What's a book that you like to recommend to people?
Gosh. I mean, this is such a kind of great, but Americana.
Such a good book.
It's so great. I mean, and I'm recognizing a pattern, right? I need a book that's like as visually stimulating mm-hmm. as a TV show. I need like an easy read. I need like some love in there.
Yeah.
You know, I need some romance.
Totally.
I need a vivid black woman as the protagonist, you know, vividly drawn black woman as the protagonist. I love Americana.
That's another good one for Tiffany.
That is another
I was going to put it on my list, but I feel like I talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
So I was like too scared to like add it.
I know. I was too scared to say it.
No,
but it's
so good. If you haven't read it, I was on vacation in Portugal and I remember it was like my family. So my brother and his fiance and my mom and her boyfriend and my husband and I, and everyone was like out by the pool and I was up in this room up above, like looking out over the resort.
Amazing.
And I just was like curled up and I had a tea and I had my book and I was like, I don't need to be around any of these people. I have my friends and my book. It's just like a really good story.
Yeah, it is a good story. It's a great story. As you were talking, I think that people I come in contact with are familiar with James Baldwin's essays, but mm-hmm. I actually am much more familiar with his novels. And so I find myself recommending, Another Country or Giovanni's Room to people.
We did Giovanni's Room on the show. It was the third book we ever did.
It puts me right back in like my early 20s or college years. Like reading Baldwin and feeling like my mind was being open to all of these, you know, thinking about Paris and, you know, what it meant to be Black in the 50s and 60s.
Right.
And yeah, so that's a recommendation that I make to people who like are talking to me about James Baldwin's, you know, thinking and, but as expressed through his essays,
right.
I often find myself saying, but have you read Go Tell It on the Mountain?
Right. Right. Yeah. I don't feel like I feel like most people think of him as one or the other and mm-hmm. don't recognize that he did so much of both.
Yeah.
And really well.
Yeah.
Which is rare, I think.
Yeah.
To do both so well.
Now that we're talking, keep going.
No, I love it.
So, I mean, again, this is another one that I'm sure you've talked about a ton on here, but I think K.S.A. Lehman's memoir Heavy is just
so good.
It's amazing. And
he was on Death, Sex,
yeah,
Money
he was.
With Damon.
Man.
Oh my God.
That
so
conversation
good.
Was incredible.
Holy shit. That was Damon. So Damon had come on the podcast right, I think, before they had recorded it. Right after they recorded it, but before it had aired, and he's like, oh, just like check it out. And as soon as it did, I like sent him a message. I was like, holy shit.
It was so brilliant.
It was so brilliant.
Oh, yo, and then the funny thing, I feel like that conversation opens with Damon being like, he had to ask Casey for something. I think it was a blurb. And he's like, I felt like I was asking you to the prom.
He talked about that on our podcast too. He was like, it was so scary. Because Damon's blurbs are like, it's like Casey and like, Ibram Kendi, it's like all of my favorite writers.
Right.
And I asked him, I was like, how did you get all these blurbs? I feel like Rebecca Traister did it or something. It was like crazy blurb action. And he talked about how he
it's
was
scary.
Like, so scary.
It's scary. We have the same agent, Tanya McKinnon.
You do.
So that's your agent can help a ton. But I also, you know, I have a blurb from KSA as well. And I was like, it did kind of feel like asking him to the prom.
You have amazing blurbs too.
Thank you.
You have really, like, I never used to pay attention to blurbs, but now I do because of the show. And I'm always like, how did you get such good people?
Yeah. I feel like email, you know, it's not like you have to go right up in someone's face and ask them and like bare your heart and ask them to do something. So email, you can kind of hide behind like the keyboard.
Yeah.
But but anyway, I mean, Heavy is like, I've only read it once. I need to go back and read it at least one more time. But I just, man, I mean, that is the conversation we need to be having about so many things. But I think a lot of, like I said, my reading is driven by my questions. And I have a lot of questions about Black masculinity. Mm. I have a lot of questions about Black masculinity. And that I just found so much, not solace, but like I felt met in my questions. Mm. You know, I felt like, oh, wow, he's willing to offer some answers that aren't really that pretty and that are really complicated.
Right. I'm going to suggest a book to you that comes out in October. It's called How We Fight for Our Lives by Saeed Jones.
Yes, that is, yep.
And I read it and...
Is it poetry?
No, it's his like
it's memoir.
And
okay.
It is, he's a queer Black man and it's about him and his mother and their relationship, but also his like finding himself in his queerness as a Black man from Texas and what that means and the violence that he perpetrates against himself and against other people in that process. And this whole thing about how you communicate with your mom and all this stuff. And when I was reading it, I thought this is the queer side of the K.S.A. Lehman coin. Mm-hmm. Not that they're necessarily the same at all, but they're in conversation with each other. Mm-hmm. Like this idea of Black masculinity when it comes to a man who's queer and like what that means and those stereotypes and how, you know, it's just, and the writing is unreal because he's a poet and kind of like the light of the world, which we'll talk about next week. There's something about when a poet writes a memoir where you're just like, this is art. Like, this shit is crazy.
Man.
You're a professional writer.
Exactly.
Like, I love the term professional writer, which I use for people who write beautifully about real shit. And like, they get it. So How We Fight for Our Lives, I believe is what it's called. And it comes out in October and high recommend.
Okay.
It's probably the best thing I've read this year so far.
Boom. I will order it.
Yeah. Check it out. So that's the last book I recommended. So I want to go back to this school thing that we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. If you were teaching school, let's say middle school, because that's what you're talking about, what would you recommend to someone?
Oh, interesting.
Or high school, if that's, you know, just kids.
Yeah. It's a great question. Because the books that, like, in high school, I remember the books that stood out were, like, we read Heart of Darkness. We read Ethan Frome. I was just like, why are these the books? Like, as a Black girl sitting in those classrooms, not to say I shouldn't have like been exposed to those books as well, but as part of a much more diverse and inclusive curriculum. So, you know, my English teacher, my 11th grade English teacher tried to teach us Their Eyes Were Watching God.
Okay.
I really respect this person a lot, but I will say he did a terrible job because he wasn't familiar with the book
at all.
And he was an older white man trying to teach this book because someone told him that he should, and he just wasn't prepared. But I wish that someone had taught me that book well as a 17-year-old or 16-year-old. That would have been very fun and exciting to feel like there was class time set aside for me to really explore that book. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. We mentioned Toni Morrison. When I was in high school, we were not taught Beloved, but the grades coming up behind me were. I would have loved to read Sula or Tar Baby in high school.
I've only read two Toni Morrison books, and both of them were for this show.
Okay.
So we did The Bluest Eye last year, and then this year, do you know Damaris B. Hill?
I don't.
She wrote a book of poetry that came out this year called A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing.
Okay.
And she came here and we did Beloved. Mm. And the whole episode, like, you can just hear me being like, whoa. Like, because I didn't love the book when I read it. I kind of was like, I don't know if I get this. I'm not super into fiction. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And she just, like, changed my whole life.
Wow.
Like, it's amazing. And that kind of, like what you're saying about the teacher didn't know how to teach Their Eyes Were Watching God. I feel like that's kind of like what we were talking about earlier, this idea that like just because a teacher is white or Black doesn't mean that they're good.
Right.
And I think that especially is true when it comes to like teaching literature and like teaching these books that are so complicated. And Damaris had read Beloved, I think like 7 times.
Yeah.
I read it once. So that was also like us coming from these two different places. But I think that like if you had a really great teacher, there's so many books that could be amazing. And if you had a shitty teacher, there's so many books that could be shitty.
Yeah.
Like it's so dependent on the teacher. Like we read The Awakening by like the Chopin sisters or whatever. It's and
like,
I was like,
oh yeah, I remember reading that.
This is a nightmare.
Yeah. Like why? Just like, why?
Like I mean, truly.
There's so many other things
to read. I didn't finish it. Turns out, spoiler alert, there's like a suicide at the end.
Yeah. I mean, I think thinking back on high school, I love memoirs, you know? Yeah. So I'm thinking of like Patti Smith's Just Kids, like about, you know, her and Robert Mapplethorpe. Yeah. Like I think if I were teaching a high school class, I would just assign a ton of memoirs.
Right.
Because when I was a teenager, all I wanted to do was imagine what my life could be like.
Right. And it's like such a window into
what could be possible if you do this or that, if you move to New York or if you stay put and try to start this thing or if you have a kid at 18, you know, it's like.
And with a memoir, you also can see other people's pain and other people's joy and that these like it's like definitely a window into another life, whether it's like a possibility or a thank God that's not me or oh my God, that is me. I'm not alone. When I was in high school, one of my biggest regrets is I had this great African-American history teacher, Mr. Green, and he assigned like really great stuff and we did like awesome stuff in my class. And he assigned the autobiography of Malcolm X and I did not read it in high school. But then right after I graduated college, I did. And I remember being like, holy shit, this is the greatest thing I've ever read. And I feel like I wish I'd read it when I had a teacher to like help me go through it.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I would have been ready at 17.
It's funny because Autobiography of Malcolm X was assigned as summer reading heading into either senior year. It was a social studies assignment heading into either junior or senior year. And you know, it's like read it over the summer, but we're never going to talk about it. I went to a predominantly white high school.
Right.
I never had a non-white teacher kindergarten through 12th grade.
Holy cow.
And so these are my memories of like, even when they thought they were doing something, they weren't doing anything.
They weren't doing anything.
It was like, we're not going to take this seriously. Read it over the summer. Oh, we're going to read Their Eyes Are Watching God, but I can't say a damn thing about it that's like insightful.
Right.
But yeah, and it's also making me think of how thankful I am for my mom because I think I was older. I was in college probably when we did this, but we would always pick usually a biography and read it together.
Mm.
Sometimes it was fluffy. Like I remember reading an Ava Gardner biography with my mom.
Yeah.
But then we also read Wrapped in Rainbows, which is this beautiful Valerie Boyd biography of Zora Neale Hurston.
Okay.
Gorgeous. And like we read that together and would talk about it. So there are ways in which like she supplemented the huge gaps.
Right. right,
in like literary education.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, school curriculum is tough. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you reported on it.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you this. You mentioned a bunch of books on mothering earlier. Do you have any other books about mothering that kind of stick out to you that are some favorites or really worth people's time besides your own We Live for the We by Dani McLean?
Well, I mean, I'll just say again, you know, Revolutionary Mothering is very important. The writings of Patricia Hill Collins, Something Like Beautiful by Asha Bandale. I really love Baby Love by Rebecca Walker. She just writes about, I think the subtitle is Choosing Motherhood After a Lifetime of Ambivalence or something like that. It's great. I read that probably I was in my early 30s. And, you know, it's just like this intimate, very personal book about her pregnancy and, you know, kind of wrestling with her own childhood and relationship with her mother and thinking about what it meant for her to become a mom. I read a lot of those books, specifically Asha Bandale, Rebecca Walker, the Sheree Moraga that I mentioned. I wanted to read, I wanted to see how there's a way in which, like, to me, to write about motherhood felt like the province of the mommy blog, right? Mm-hmm. Just like not taken seriously.
Right.
And so I wanted to see how these writers who I take very seriously approach the topic because I wanted to write a serious book about motherhood myself. And so those were a couple of books that I leaned on.
Okay. So I just have one more question for you, which is if you could require the current president of the United States to read one book, what would it be?
I keep thinking of books and then thinking like, but he wouldn't get that unless he'd already read this. You know what I mean?
Well, we'll have to also assume that he has reading comprehension and all those things. Like that if he read it, that he would understand it and would finish it and would pay attention.
Right, right.
Because otherwise, who knows?
I mean, I'm going to just say a couple writers who I would like for him to read. Robin Kelly.
Okay.
He's a historian. who's written a lot about the radical imagination. Mm-hmm. I got turned on to Robin D.G. Kelly when I was in college because I studied African American history and I was particularly interested in the relationship between the Communist Party and Black folks, like in the 30s and 40s. And he wrote a book called Hammer and Hoe that shaped me. So I would suggest that he read some Robin Kelly so that he could, Robin's a historian. So I would want him to get grounded in a history of this country mm-hmm. that I think would challenge a lot of his understandings of what this country is about.
That's good. That's a really good answer. Okay. So that's it for us today. Before we move on, just a reminder, Dani's book is We Live for the We, The Political Power of Black Motherhood. It's out in the world. It's been out for a while. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. Even if you think I'm not black or I'm not a mother, I think that you'll get something out of it. I got a lot out of it. A lot, a lot, a lot. Next week, Dani and I will be back. We're going to be talking about The Light of the World, which is a memoir by Elizabeth Alexander. If you're on the fence about this book, I was on the fence. I wasn't sure. And I freaking loved it. And then I found out that it was Michelle Obama's favorite book of 2015. Oh. So you have a cosign from me and Michelle Obama. I'm not sure which one's more valuable to you, but you have it from both of us. There will probably be some spoilers, but there's not really a ton to spoil. The book is about what it's about. And as soon as you open the book, you know what it's about. So that will be next week. Dani, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Yay. And we will see you guys in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening to today's episode. And thank you to Dani McLean for being our guest. I also want to say thank you to Jocelyn Pedro for setting up this interview and getting us a copy of We Live for the We. Don't forget, next week, we're back to discuss The Light of the World by Elizabeth Alexander. Everything we talked about on today's episode can be found in the show notes. And make sure you link up with The Stacks on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show and more, go to patreon.com/thestacks and join the fun. If you're looking for a book recommendation, email us at askingthestacks@gmail.com to get your recommendation read on air. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. I will see you in the stacks.